Chapter 7. Empathy. Yesterday was rough. I worked nonstop from the time I awoke, straining to meet a couple of deadlines, trying to squirm out of an unexpected new assignment, and contending with a 7-year-old with a runny nose, a 5-year-old with a loose tooth, and an 18-month-old who was teaching himself cause and effect by pushing ceramics off a counter. In the afternoon, I ran 5 miles. After a rushed dinner, I returned to my office and worked a few more hours until I was too tired to concentrate. At about 10 o'clock, bone-tired, I went to bed. Except I couldn't sleep. I read a little, then tried again. No go. So around 1 a.m., I went downstairs, poured myself a glass of wine, and read the previous day's newspaper. Then another glass of wine. Then another newspaper. At 2:15, I went back upstairs and tried again. Finally, I did fall asleep, sometime after 3:06, the last numbers I remember seeing on the clock radio beside my bed. About 3 hours later, the 18-month-old stood up in his crib and began bellowing his traditional morning milk chant. By 7 a.m., the house had erupted into full morning mania, and by 8 a.m., I was back in my office, where I now sit, facing another day of deadlines. I'm tired. Really tired. In fact, I just yawned. And as I think about the day before me, I'm yawning again. Despite the 3 cups of coffee I've just guzzled, I could fall asleep in about 30 seconds. But sleep will have to wait. Too much to do. So I soldier on. And I yawn. Stop for a moment. In the past 2 minutes, have you yawned? When you listened to my account of sleepiness and then pictured me yawning, did you feel an inkling of a yawn creep toward your jaw? If so, you probably have a natural inclination for the next essential aptitude. Empathy. If you didn't yawn, in order to trigger this innate capacity, you may need a story more emotionally compelling than my boo-hoo tale of overworking and undersleeping. Empathy is the ability to imagine yourself in someone else's position and to intuit what that person is feeling. It is the ability to stand in others' shoes, see with their eyes, and to feel with their hearts. It is something we do pretty much spontaneously, an act of instinct, rather than the product of deliberation. But empathy isn't sympathy, that is, feeling bad for someone else. It is feeling with someone else, sensing what it would be like to be that person. Empathy is a stunning act of imaginative derring-do, the ultimate virtual reality, climbing into another's mind to experience the world from that person's perspective. And because it requires attuning oneself to another, empathy often involves an element of mimicry, which is why some of you yawned a moment ago. Contagious yawning, says Drexel University cognitive scientist Stephen Plotek, is likely a primitive empathic mechanism. His research has found that contagious yawners score high on various tests that measure levels of empathy. Such people, some of you no doubt, are so in tune with what others are going through that they can't help but mimic that behavior. Empathy is mighty important. It helped our species climb out of the evolutionary muck. And now that we're upright and bipedal, the big animals on campus, it still helps us get through the day. Empathy allows us to see the other side of an argument, comfort someone in distress, and bite our lip instead of muttering something snide. Empathy builds self-awareness, bonds parent to child, allows us to work together, and provides the scaffolding for our morality. But empathy, like many of the other high-concept, high-touch aptitudes, wasn't always given its proper due in the information age. It was often considered a soft-hearted nicety in a world that demanded hard-headed detachment. To undermine an argument or dismiss an idea, you just had to call it touchy-feely. Or look at the drubbing former U.S. President Bill Clinton took when he uttered these 4 words. I feel your pain. Some critics thought Clinton was dissembling when he said that, But the roughest criticism came from those who considered the comment laughably unpresidential and even a tad unmanly. Americans pay presidents to think, not to feel, to strategize, not to empathize, or so it has long been. The era of sharp-minded knowledge workers and briskly efficient high-tech companies prized emotional distance and cool reason, the ability to step back, assess the situation, and make a decision unimpeded by emotion. But as with so many other attributes of L-directed thinking, we are beginning to see the limits of such a single-minded approach. Daniel Goleman's book, Emotional Intelligence, published about the same time Clinton uttered his empathic words, signaled the beginning of this shift. Goleman argued that emotional abilities are even more important than conventional intellectual abilities, and the world took to his message. But more than a decade later, the conceptual age is increasing the stakes. When Goleman wrote his book, the internet was in its infancy, and those highly skilled Indian programmers of Chapter 2 were in elementary school. Today, cheap and widespread online access, combined with all those overseas knowledge workers, are making the attributes measurable by IQ much easier to replace, which, as we have seen in earlier chapters, has meant that aptitudes more difficult to replicate are becoming more valuable. And the one aptitude that's proven impossible for computers to reproduce and very difficult for faraway workers connected by electrons to match is empathy. Facing the future. In 1872, 13 years after he published On the Origin of Species, Charles Darwin published another book that scandalized Victorian society. The book was called The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, and it made some controversial claims. Most notably, Darwin said that all mammals have emotions, and that one way they convey these emotions is through their facial expressions. A dog with a lugubrious look on its face probably is sad, just as a person who's frowning probably is unhappy. Darwin's book caused a stir when it came out, but for the next century it languished in obscurity. The assumption in the world of psychology and science was that our faces did express emotion, but that those expressions were products of culture rather than nature. But in 1965, Paul Ekman, then a young psychologist and now a legendary one, came along. Ekman, an American, traveled to Japan, Argentina, Brazil, and Chile. He showed people there photos of faces fixed in various expressions, and he found that Asians and South Americans interpreted the expressions the same way Americans did. He was intrigued. Perhaps these common interpretations were due to television or Western influence, he thought. So Ekman journeyed to the highlands of New Guinea and showed the same set of facial expression photos to tribespeople who'd never seen television or even a Westerner before. They read the faces the same way all of Ekman's previous subjects did. And that led him to a groundbreaking conclusion. Darwin was right after all. Facial expressions were universal. Raising eyebrows indicated surprise in midtown Manhattan, just as it did in suburban Buenos Aires, just as it did in the highlands of New Guinea. Ekman has devoted much of his career to studying facial expressions. He created the set of photographs that I looked at back in Chapter 1 when I was getting my brain scanned. His work is enormously important for our purposes. Empathy is largely about emotion, feeling what another is feeling. But emotions generally don't reveal themselves in L-directed ways. People's emotions are rarely put into words. Far more often, they are expressed through other cues, writes Goleman. Just as the mode of the rational mind is words, the mode of emotions is nonverbal. And the main canvas for displaying those emotions is the face. With 43 tiny muscles that tug and stretch and lift our mouth, eyes, cheeks, eyebrows, and forehead, our faces can convey the full range of human feeling. Since empathy depends on emotion, and since emotion is conveyed nonverbally, to enter another's heart, you must begin the journey by looking into his face. As we learned in Chapter 1, reading facial expressions is a specialty of our brain's right hemisphere. When I looked at extreme expressions, unlike when I looked at scary scenes, the fMRI showed that the right side of my brain responded more robustly than my left. We both express our own emotions and read the emotions of others primarily through the right hemisphere, says one George Washington University neurologist. That's why, according to research at the University of Sussex, the vast majority of women, regardless of whether they are right-handed or left-handed, cradle babies on their left side. Since babies can't talk, the only way we can understand their needs is by reading their expressions and intuiting their emotions. So we depend on our right hemisphere, which we enlist by turning to the left. You'll recall from Chapter 1 that our brains are contralateral. People with damage to their right hemisphere have great difficulty recognizing the emotions on others' faces. The same is often true for those with autism, which in some cases entails a malfunction of the right hemisphere. By contrast, people with damage to the left side of the brain, the side that in most people processes language, are actually better at reading expressions than the rest of us. For instance, both Ekman and Nancy Etcoff, a psychologist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, have shown that most of us are astonishingly bad at detecting when someone is lying. When we try to determine from another's facial expressions or tone of voice if that person is fibbing, we don't do much better than if we had offered random guesses. But aphasics, people with damage to their brain's left hemisphere that compromises their ability to speak and understand language, are exceptionally good lie detectors. By reading facial cues, Etcoff found, they can spot liars more than 70% of the time. The reason? Since they can't receive one channel of communication, they're better at interpreting the other, more expressive channel. The conceptual age puts a premium on this more elusive but more expressive channel. Endowing computers with emotional intelligence has been a dream for decades, but even the best scientists in the field of affective computing haven't made much progress. Computers still do a shabby job of even distinguishing one face from another, let alone detecting the subtle expressions etched onto them. Computers have tremendous mathematical abilities, says Rosalind Picard of MIT, but when it comes to interacting with people, they are autistic. Voice recognition software can now decipher our words, whether we tell our laptop to save or delete, or whether we request aisle or window to an automated airline attendant. But the most sophisticated software on the planet running on the world's most powerful computers can't divine our emotions. Some newer applications are getting better at spotting the existence of emotion. For instance, some kinds of voice recognition software used in call centers can detect big changes in pitch, timing, and volume, all of which signal heightened emotion. But what happens when the software recognizes these signals? It transfers the call to an actual human being. That example is a microcosm for work in the conceptual age. Work that can be reduced to rules, whether the rules are embedded in a few lines of software code or handed to a low-paid overseas worker, requires relatively little empathy. Such work will largely disappear from countries like the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. But the work that remains will demand a much deeper understanding of the subtleties of human interaction than ever before. No surprise, then, that students at Stanford Business School are flocking to a course officially called Interpersonal Dynamics, but known around campus as touchy-feely. Or consider a field not typically known for emotional literacy, the practice of law. Much legal research can now be done by English-speaking lawyers in other parts of the world. Likewise, software and websites, as I explained earlier in this audiobook, have eliminated the monopoly lawyers once had on certain specialized information. So which lawyers will remain? Those who can empathize with their clients and understand their true needs. Those who can sit in a negotiation and figure out the subtext of the discussion that's coursing beneath the explicit words. And those who can look at a jury, read their expressions, and instantly know whether they're making a persuasive case. These empathic abilities have always been important to lawyers, but now they've become a key point of differentiation in this and other professions. But empathy is much more than a vocational skill necessary for surviving 21st century labor markets. It's an ethic for living. It's a means of understanding other human beings. As Darwin and Ekman found, a universal language that connects us beyond country or culture. Empathy makes us human. Empathy brings joy. And as we'll see in Chapter 9, empathy is an essential part of living a life of meaning. Many of us can boost our powers of empathy, and nearly all of us can improve our ability to read faces. Over the years, Ekman has compiled an atlas of facial expressions, likely all the facial expressions that human beings throughout the world use to convey emotions. And he's found that 7 basic human emotions have clear facial signals: anger, sadness, fear, surprise, disgust, contempt, and happiness. Sometimes these expressions are full and intense. Many other times they are less conspicuous. There's what Ekman calls the slight expression, which is usually the first prickle of an emotion or the failed attempt to hide that emotion. There's the partial expression, and there's the micro expression, which flashes across the face in less than 1/5 of a second and often occurs when a person is consciously trying to conceal all signs of how he or she is feeling. Ekman has taught face reading skills to agents from the FBI, CIA, and ATF, as well as to police officers, judges, lawyers, and even illustrators and animators. And now I'm going to try to teach you one aspect of Ekman's techniques. You can learn more of them in the portfolio at the end of this chapter. I've always been irritated by what I think are fake smiles, but I've never been sure whether someone is grinning because he's charmed by my wit, or smiling precisely because he isn't. Now I know. A smile of true enjoyment is what Ekman calls the Duchenne smile, after the French neurologist Duchenne de Boulogne, who conducted pioneering work in this field in the late 1800s. A genuine smile involves 2 facial muscles. One, the zygomatic major muscle, which stretches from the cheekbone and lifts the corners of the mouth, and 2, the outer part of the orbicularis oculi muscle, which orbits the eye and is involved in pulling down the eyebrows and the skin below the eyebrows, pulling up the skin below the eyes, and raising the cheeks. Artificial smiles involve only the zygomatic major. The reason? We can control that muscle, but we can't control the relevant part of the orbicularis oculi muscle. It contracts spontaneously, and only when we're actually experiencing enjoyment. As Duchenne himself put it, the emotion of frank joy is expressed on the face by the combined contraction of the zygomaticus major muscle and the orbicularis oculi. The first obeys the will, but the second is only put into play by the sweet emotions of the soul. In other words, to detect a fake smile, look at the eyes. If the outer muscle of the orbicularis isn't contracting, the person beaming at you may be a false friend. A whole new healthcare. Empathy is not a standalone aptitude. It connects to the 3 high-concept, high-touch aptitudes I've already discussed. Empathy is an essential part of design, because good designers put themselves in the mind of whoever is going to experience the product or service they're designing. Empathy is related to symphony, because empathic people understand the importance of context. They see the whole person, much as symphonic thinkers see the whole picture. Finally, the aptitude of story also involves empathy. As we saw in the section on narrative medicine, stories can be pathways to empathy, especially for physicians. But empathy is also reshaping medicine more directly. Several leaders in the medical field are urging that the profession shift its overarching approach from detached concern to empathy, as bioethicist Jody Halpern puts it. The detached scientific model isn't inappropriate, they say. It's insufficient. As I've mentioned, much of medical practice has been standardized, reduced to a set of repeatable formulas for diagnosing and treating various ailments. While some doctors have criticized this development as cookbook medicine, it has many strengths. Rules-based medicine builds on the accumulated evidence of hundreds and sometimes thousands of cases. It helps ensure that medical professionals don't reinvent the therapeutic wheel with each patient. But the truth is, computers could do some of this work. What they can't do, Remember, when it comes to human relations, computers are autistic, is to be empathic. Empathy can be a powerful force in medicine. For example, a few years ago, two postal workers went to different health centers complaining of similar symptoms. One man told his doctor he felt achy and ill, and he believed he'd been exposed to anthrax, which had recently been found at the postal facility where he worked. The doctor telephoned the relevant public health departments, which told him that anthrax was not a risk and that he need not prescribe antibiotics. So he followed the rules and sent his patient home with orders to take some Tylenol. A few days later, the patient died of anthrax. Meanwhile, the other postal worker went to an emergency room at a different hospital just a few miles away. His doctor, who didn't know about that earlier patient, examined the worker and suspected that he'd contracted pneumonia. But then the man told her that he worked at the postal facility hit with an anthrax scare. So she ordered another test. And even though she didn't think he had anthrax, something still nagged at her. She gave the man a prescription for Cipro, the antibiotic prescribed for anthrax, just in case. And instead of sending him home, as she had initially planned, she kept him at the hospital and referred him to an infectious disease specialist. As it turned out, the man did have anthrax. And as it also turned out, the doctor's empathic listening, intuition, and willingness to deviate from the rules meant the difference between life and death. "I just listened to my patient," she told the Wall Street Journal. "He said, 'I know my body and something's just not right.'" Empathy, his doctor's ability to intuit what someone else was feeling, saved his life. Physicians express empathy not only by making accurate comments about a patient's feelings, but by their timing, vocal tones, pauses, and overall attunement to the affective style of a patient, says Halpern. Empathy supplements objective knowledge and the use of technology and other tools for making accurate diagnoses. As this new view of doctoring takes hold, the aptitude of empathy is moving to the forefront of the medical profession. It is giving way to a new generation of healthcare professionals like that emergency room physician, people who can combine rule-based detachment with emotion-based empathy into a whole new medicine. The board that accredits medical schools now makes communicating effectively and empathically with patients a factor in a student doctor's overall evaluation. That may seem like a common sense move, and it is, but in the heavily L-directed medical profession, it's a sea change. Meantime, stage actress Megan Cole travels to medical schools across the United States teaching a course called The Craft of Empathy. In the class, she instructs doctors in training how to use nonverbal cues such as facial expression, intonation, body language, as well as other acting techniques to better grasp what ails patients and to better convey concern for them. Students at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine take courses in communicating and apologizing for their mistakes. And Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia, which I mentioned in Chapter 3, has even developed a measure of this aptitude, the Jefferson Scale of Physician Empathy, or JSPE. Although it is relatively new, the JSPE has produced some intriguing results. For example, high scores on the empathy test generally correlated with high marks on clinical care. That is, all other things being equal, a patient was more likely to get better with an empathic doctor than with a detached one. What's more, scores on the empathy test bore no relation to scores on the MCAT or on medical licensing tests, which means that the traditional measures of physician aptitude aren't necessarily relevant to determining who's the best doctor. The differences in who scored high on the JSPE and who didn't were also interesting. Women generally scored higher than men, and certain kinds of health professionals scored better than others. For instance, nurses generally had high scores, much higher than physicians with hospital-based specialties. The growing recognition of empathy's role in healing is one reason why nursing will be one of the key professions of the conceptual age workforce. Nurses do much more than just empathize, of course, but the sort of emotionally intelligent care they often provide is precisely the sort of thing that's impossible to outsource or automate. Radiologists in Bangalore can read X-rays, But it's hard to deliver empathy, touch, presence, and comfort via fiber optic cable. And with the aging of the population in the advanced world, nurses are in huge demand. In the United States, nursing will account for more new jobs over the next decade than any other profession. U.S. health facilities will need 1 million additional nurses. Nurses have many complaints about being overworked and having to juggle too many patients. But their empathic nature keeps them in high esteem and increasingly brings them higher salaries. Nursing consistently rates as the most honest and ethical profession in the United States, according to an annual Gallup survey, and its pay is rising faster than nearly every other job category. The rise of empathy has even begun to color parental advice. In a recent survey of Australian information technology managers, 90% said they would not recommend that their own children pursue careers in the L-directed field of software engineering. What would they recommend their children do instead? "I'd rather my kids opt for nursing as a profession," said James Michaels, who works for a telecommunications company in Sydney. "It has both global and local demand." Men, women, and empathy. Who's more empathic, men or women? The politically correct answer is to say neither, that empathy depends on the individual. And to a large extent, that's true. But a growing body of research has begun making that politically correct view untenable. Dozens of studies, for instance, have shown that women are generally better at reading facial expressions and at detecting lies. Even as early as age 3, girls are better at inferring what others are thinking and at divining emotions from the expression on someone's face. Summarizing this research, psychologist David G. Myers writes, "When surveyed, women are far more likely to describe themselves as empathic, as being able to rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. To a lesser extent, the gender gap in empathy extends to observed behavior. Women are somewhat more likely to cry or report feeling distressed at another's distress. The empathy difference helps explain why both men and women report their friendships with women to be more intimate, enjoyable, and nurturing than their friendships with men. When seeking empathy and understanding, both men and women usually turn to women." Simon Baron Cohen, a Cambridge University psychologist, has a theory that explains this apparent gender gap. He states it plainly on page 1 of his 2003 book, The Essential Difference. "The female brain is predominantly hardwired for empathy. The male brain is predominantly hardwired for understanding and building systems." Baron is quick to note that not all women have female brains and not all men have male brains, but he marshals an array of support for his central point, that more males than females have brains that systematize and that more females than males have brains that empathize. The differences in the two thinking styles, as Baron Cohen describes them, are intriguing. "Systematizing involves exactness, excellent attention to local detail, and an attraction to fixed rules independent of context," he says. "To systematize, you need detachment." But empathizing is different. As Baron Cohen puts it, "To empathize, you need some degree of attachment in order to recognize that you are interacting with a person, not an object, but a person with feelings, and whose feelings affect your own." Empathy, he says, involves inexactness. One can only ever approximate when one ascertains another's mental state. Empathy involves attention to the larger picture, what one thinks he thinks or feels about other people, for example. Empathy involves context. A person's face, voice, action, and history are all essential information in determining that person's mental state. Empathy has no expectation of lawfulness. What made her happy yesterday may not make her happy tomorrow. Detachment and following rules on one hand, inexactness, context, and the big picture on the other. The male brain sounds a little like L-directed thinking, and the female brain sounds a lot like the high-concept, high-touch approach of R-directed thinking. The two thinking styles also sound like the differing approaches of the two doctors treating anthrax patients I mentioned earlier, one of whom happened to be a man and the other a woman. Does this mean we all need to get in touch with the feminine side of our brains, especially those of us with hairy arms and deep voices? Yes. But it doesn't mean rejecting the systematizing side of our brains. Empathy is neither a deviation from intelligence nor the single route to it. Sometimes we need detachment. Many other times we need attunement. And the people who will thrive will be those who can toggle between the two. As we've seen again and again, the conceptual age requires androgynous minds. Empathy portfolio. Test yourself. Psychologists have developed an array of tests to measure individual empathy and related qualities. Many of these tests are available free on the web, and they're an excellent introduction to the subject as well as a fun way to learn more about yourself. But, caveat test taker, the web is full of self-assessments, many of which have all the scientific validity of phrenology. So begin your empathy testing regimen with these. Empathy quotient. Measure your EQ with Simon Baron-Cohen's 60-question instrument, which will determine whether you have a female brain. If you want to check your male brain bona fides, also take the test that measures your systematizing quotient, or SQ. Spot the fake smile. Take the BBC's 10-minute, 20-question test based on Paul Ekman's research to see how good you are at detecting the difference between a fake smile and a real one. Mind in the eyes test. Another test from Simon Baron-Cohen. This one measures your ability to identify a facial expression from only a person's eyes. The Mayer Salovey Caruso Emotional Intelligence Test. This is probably the most widely respected emotional intelligence test available today. But unlike the others I mentioned, to take this one, you'll have to pay. It's not the place to start your investigation, but it's a great option for those who want to dig deeper. You can find the URLs for all of these online instruments by putting the name of the instrument in your favorite search engine, or if that doesn't work, just email me at dpp@danpink.com and I'll send you the URL. Study Ekman. As I noted earlier in this chapter, the world's leading expert on facial expressions is Paul Ekman. Do yourself a favor and study his work. Read his latest book, Emotions Revealed. It's an excellent overview of the science of expression, and it's a first-rate guide to learning the techniques to decipher the emotions revealed on someone else's face. Ekman's daughter Eve is the model for many of the emotions pictured in the book, and she has an uncanny ability to get the expressions just right. If you like Emotions Revealed, also check out Ekman's earlier book, Telling Lies, which, among other things, explains how to detect when someone is fibbing. Then, for your graduate degree in Ekmanship, pick up his two interactive CD-ROM tutorials. One, the micro-expression training tool, teaches you to spot those fleeting micro-expressions. The other, the subtle expression training tool, teaches you to spot the seemingly undetectable expressions that occur when someone is just beginning to feel an emotion. The tutorials include pretests to measure your current ability, and at the end, final tests to see how much you've improved. Both are useful, not to mention fascinating. One warning, though, to my fellow Mac users. As of press time, these CD-ROMs worked only with PCs. For more information, go to Paul Ekman's website, www.paulekman.com. Another suggestion, eavesdrop. Several years ago, writer and former literary escort Naomi Apple published a small paperback book and companion card set called The Observation Deck. Apple's package is a wonderful trove of writing tips assembled from authors she shepherded on book tours. One of those tips is also a fine way to develop greater powers of empathy. Eavesdrop. Listening to the conversations of those nearby has a bad reputation, but we all do it, so we might as well make it worthwhile. Next time you're in a position to eavesdrop, listen carefully to what your targets are saying. Then imagine yourself as one of those people in that situation. What are you, that is him or her, thinking and feeling at that moment? What emotions, if any, are coursing through your body? How did you end up in this particular place, at this particular time? Many writers are notorious eavesdroppers, Apple writes, citing, among others, F. Scott Fitzgerald, who kept a notebook in which he recorded overheard conversations. But the practice is valuable to a range of professions, if done in moderation and within the boundaries of the law, of course. It's an excellent way to put yourself in another's shoes and see the world through that person's eyes, if only for a few moments. One variation. Listen to a conversation without looking at the people who are talking. Then guess who the people are, their ages, their ethnicities, their clothing style. Turn around to see how accurate you are. You might be surprised. Play Whose Life? IDEO is one of the world's most respected design firms, the creator of everything from those fat-handled toothbrushes for kids to Apple Computer's first mouse to the Palm 5. How do they do it? The secret would make an MBA squirm. Empathy. In the IDEO universe, great design doesn't begin with a cool drawing or nifty gadget. It begins with a deep and empathic understanding of people. Here's an exercise in empathy that I learned when I visited IDEO's Palo Alto, California headquarters. Ask someone in your organization to lend you her purse, briefcase, or backpack. Also ask that person to remove the things inside that bear her name. Then gather a group of 5 or 6 other people and review the contents, without knowing who the person is, to try to determine what sort of life, personal, professional, emotional, the person lives. For instance, is the bag crammed with things, or is it spare and neat? Is everything inside related to work, or are there items that indicate a family life or other interests? How much money is in the wallet? Does this person carry any photographs? Pick through the artifacts like a purse-snatching archaeologist, and you can really begin to imagine what it's like to be that person. Added bonus, Whose Life is a lot of fun. And IDEO has collected some of its other techniques and stamped them onto 51 funky oversized cards that are available online and in a few American stores for $49. These IDEO method cards detail an array of strategies borrowed from anthropology, psychology, biomechanics, and other disciplines for putting empathy at the center of the design process. Like conventional playing cards, the method cards are organized into 4 suits that represent 4 methods of empathizing with people. Look, learn, ask, and try. Each individual card explains a particular technique, say, camera journal or body storming, with a photo on one side and on the other an account of how IDEO has used the technique with a client. These cards are almost as fun as rifling through someone's purse. For more information, go to IDEO's website, www.ideo.com. Here's another suggestion. Empathize on the job. Even though we all say we believe in empathy, we often fail to demonstrate it with the very people who surround us most of our daylight hours, our coworkers. Here are 2 techniques for increasing empathy within your organization and team. 1. A day in the life. Do you know what work is really like for your colleagues? This activity will help you find out. It's easy to do and great for staff meetings or retreats. Have each participant write her name on a piece of flip chart paper and then list 4 categories: my highs, my lows, my frustrations, my rewards. Post all these sheets on the walls. Then ask everyone to walk around the room and write what they think the answers are for their colleagues. What's the biggest frustration of the senior vice president? What's the greatest reward for the fellow in the mailroom? Once people write what they think, each person reclaims his own sheet. Then, everyone takes a turn responding to his colleague's guesses and explaining what a workday is really like. A variation. Organize people by departments and have each group try to describe a day in the life of the other departments. 2. How did I get here? Sometimes you work near people for years, but have little idea about the path that brought them alongside of you. Understanding these personal histories is the goal of an activity that consultant Kevin Buck uses with groups of physicians. He invites doctors to pair up and tell the story of why they chose the arduous path of medicine. Each doctor relates her own story, listens to her partner's story, and then retells the partner's story to the rest of the group. A process that Buck says is always very powerful and renewing. After the storytelling, he elicits the common themes from the community of physicians, the result of which is a new narrative that runs counter to the dominant story of disdain and negativity that most felt in the healthcare community. Buck has used this technique with other groups of professionals with similar success. A final suggestion. Take an acting class. Americans of a certain age will remember the television commercial that began, "I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV." These days, that piece of Americana is being turned upside down. Doctors are pretending to be actors. Increasing numbers of physicians are working to understand and deepen their empathy by taking acting classes. It sounds either dubious or duplicitous, I know, but think about what actors do. They try to inhabit the mind and heart of another person, and that makes acting a great way to understand emotion and emotional expression. Most local colleges and community centers offer evening classes, and while the instructors aren't exactly Lee Strasberg, you're not exactly Al Pacino. So if you're game, give it a try. You might learn something.